From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Atlanta, Georgia. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Well, how are you today? How have the consequences of the outcome of the presidential election impacted you? Now, knowing the diversity of our nation, I'm sure that answers to my question run the gamut of emotions and convictions, ecstatic jubilation and quiet depression, resentment and resignation, hope and a sense of doom, satisfaction and angst, expectation and anger. Each of those is motivated by personal values. Amid those who didn't support President-elect Donald Trump, the dominating emotion is fear. But honestly, friends, fear has been the most prevalent emotion throughout this whole election cycle. Each candidate peddled fear profusely. I guess for at least a year and a half, fear has been the weapon of choice, or you might say the primal motivation of political preference for facilitating change and commending the right candidate to support in the presidential campaign. False reasons for fear were as prolific as the vulnerabilities of the electorate. You know what it sounded like. A giant global strategy for stealing our money will ruin us. She's going to take our guns away from us. If I don't vote for Mr. Trump, I'm going to hell. My pastor said so. Our democracy is rigged. Our government is out to get us. Our economy is failing. Our military leaders are inept, and ISIS is on its way to our doorsteps. You know these words. The multiple fears that manipulated numerous voters arrived on, I'm sad to say, on a tsunami of lies. And look, these were not small lies. They were not minor exaggerations. They were a relentless, coordinated, and ultimately successful basket of big lies, legitimized by being seriously discussed in mainstream media and effectively stoking fear and mistrust of government, of the voting system, of a free press, of professionalism and experience, and ultimately of each other, a mistrust of each other. Now, on the bright side, I suppose, we have not heard much at all about the rigging of elections since Wednesday morning. So there's that. You know, I do not fear the president-elect nearly so much as I fear the mindset of a nation that would invite into the Oval Office a leader with no experience in public service and little recognition of the importance of the moral values of our democracy, long affirmed by both our many religions and good citizens who have chosen to embrace no religion. We have just witnessed the historic democratic process manipulated as a tool for eroding democracy. Now get that. We've used the process of democracy to weaken democracy. Now, there are good reasons for fear right now. The danger of leadership by a person who values no thoughts but his own. The danger of decisions ruthlessly made with no acknowledgement of our Constitution. the danger of a further erosion of religious freedom based on a lack of understanding of religious freedom as defined in the First Amendment. The danger of people in the LGBTQ community being stripped of their hard-won rights to basic dignity, safety, same-gender love, and equality in marriage. The danger of an undisciplined ego that could catapult us into a major world war. And the danger of a person for whom money is a deity and religion is a way of linking loyalty to God to advocacy for political partisanship. You know, the most immediate reaction to the consequences of this national election is fear. Fear in the lives of Muslims and Jews whose singular guilt is to be members of the wrong religion. Fear in the lives of people who always have valued the hospitality of the American people that welcome to our shores people seeking refuge from persecution and war. And it's very, very small comfort that the strongest defense throughout the campaign has been surrogates insisting the candidate didn't really say what he said or mean what he said, or it's somehow the media's fault to be talking about what he said, even while those things which he really did say drew unsavory and un-American supporters to his campaign. It was jarring to see houses of worship across the country open their doors on the day after the election to gather and comfort their communities, as if a natural disaster had occurred. It was worrisome to see thousands of Americans in the streets marching through our cities and chanting, "Not my president." That level of disaffection undermines our democracy itself, and we must hope it dissipates quickly. As reports of the election results flowed in, I listened and tightened my hug of one of my grandsons who, on the night of the election, said, "Papa, will you please keep this mean man from hurting me?" My hope is that President-elect Trump immediately will help allay these fears if he can do so with honesty. No law-observing peaceful citizen, young or old, should ever have to fear the President of the United States or be terrified by his curses and threats. Well, it took some discipline. With severe discipline, I made myself think through fragments of hope. We haven't experienced a coup this week, you know. Blood's not in the streets. Armies are not positioned in our neighborhoods. The Electoral College, created by our Constitution, has carried out the will of the American people by confirming Donald Trump as the president-elect of our nation. President Obama already has set in motion a peaceable transition of power so as to have no interruption or compromise of the rights and freedoms of all people in this nation. Folks, we still have a democracy. We still have a democracy that gives each of us the freedom to express our convictions in public and organize other people who share our values. Right now, many nonprofit organizations are pounding out a new strategy for a changed world. Any one of us can be an integral part of that process and continue our lives with devotion to political action that can correct what went wrong in this most recent election. Today, we are a more deeply divided nation than when the first words of this election cycle were spoken. Indeed, division has been a tool during this election cycle. But listen, please. Diversity does not demand division. From its inception, our nation has cherished the idea of E Pluribus Unum, many different people working together in a union dedicated to cooperation, mutual respect, and civil rights. As I see it, the best response to this ugly election, ostensibly for change, is for each of us to affirm our own dignity and worth and embrace our duty as good citizens committed to liberty and justice for all, to actual facts and reality, not propaganda and not lies large or small, and to relentless protest of anything less than that reality. Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University, where he heads up several invaluable programs for students, drawing upon his personal experience inside several presidential campaigns. For years, Greg has generously agreed to be on this show to talk electoral politics, and I'm very grateful to have him with us once more. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. It's good to be back.
A few days have passed now since Tuesday's voting. Should we have seen what was coming?
Well, I guess the answer is yes and no. I think that if we were watching the polls, there was no indication that what was going to happen was going to happen. But I guess in a broader sense, we've just gone through an election cycle that was riddled with surprises from the very beginning. So I guess in that respect, we shouldn't be completely blown away that there was a surprise at the end. We saw a lot of things sort of going at the end, the renewal of the FBI investigation and a few other things. We know that this has been just an incredibly volatile year, but I don't think most people expected it to be quite as volatile as it was at the very end.
So does that mean that we better just hang on because there may be a lot more surprises still on the way?
You know, the pressure is on the president-elect now. Who does he speak to? Who does he speak for? What does he do? Does he continue to make the case to the sort of radical fringe of the Republican Party? Does he try to move to the middle? He's got to make some very, very difficult decisions. You know, how is he going to deal with Congress? He's got a lot of folks in Congress who were not thrilled with his nomination, don't agree with a lot of what he presented as his policies. And I think there are an awful lot, more than usual, unanswered questions about where this is all going to go. I note that already just since Tuesday, he has a reference to banning Muslims from the United States has disappeared from his website. One of his campaign staff indicated that the wall between us and Mexico was a metaphor. So there seems to be an attempt to sort of move toward the middle, but who knows from day to day where this will take us.
Greg, what were the defining themes that led to a Trump victory that got overlooked by almost all analysts and pollsters, in your opinion?
I think alienation. I think that the level of alienation and anger toward Washington, toward the state of things, the state of the economy and other things was grossly underestimated and missed. I mean, we saw people coming to the polls who had not been to the polls in a long time. Hillary Clinton didn't do that badly. They were just overwhelmed by numbers of particularly white men that no one had any inclination were coming.
Greg, this may be the most pressing question that many Americans have on their minds right now, and I want to get your thoughts on it. We've seen the kind of folks Donald Trump has surrounded himself with during the campaign. So what do you think his administration is going to look like?
A huge question mark, I think. Politico produced a list of names that have been tossed around as possible cabinet officers. And I got to tell you, most of them, to me, are kind of frightening. Rudy Giuliani is on the list. Newt Gingrich is on the list. Chris Christie is on the list. And most unbelievable, Sarah Palin is on the list as a possible Secretary of Interior. If this is really the direction he goes in, I think this answers the question about whether Trump feels the need to carry the water for that fringe element that seems to have gotten him where he is, as opposed to moving a little bit toward the center to govern. But again, we have to wait and see as these names get through the process who we end up with as his advisors, because we know this president is going to be particularly reliant on his advisors, because he's not a guy who's given us any indication that he has a great deal of knowledge or, frankly, interest in some of the minutiae of governing.
During the campaign, many of the promises Trump made were dismissed by his surrogates over and over. But they attracted at least some of his voters, those things that they wanted to say we didn't understand. The voters understood it to be just what he said. So how bound to those promises do you think the president-elect will be, whether we're talking about the wall with Mexico or Muslim Americans or undocumented immigrants?
Yeah, he's just as bound as he thinks he is. He may decide, and there are indications already, that at least some people who are speaking on his behalf are moving away from some of those what I would call outrageous proposals, the wall, the temporary ban on Muslims. And there's no indication yet as to the direction he's going to go, but he's going to have to make some decisions about who he's speaking for. Is he going to continue to carry that message from his base, or is he going to try to move away? Now, both sides carry challenges and danger for him, because he needs to finally to develop a broader base of support, I think, particularly looking toward, can't believe I'm saying this already, but particularly looking toward the midterm elections in a couple of years. But at the same time, he can't really afford to have all of those folks that made up his base looking at him and going, oh, my God, he was making all this up. He didn't mean a word of it. So he's got a challenge. He's got a very significant challenge before him.
You talked about he's already taken some of the issues off of the website that represents his thoughts. How can he do that and even begin with the credibility he needs to please his supporters?
Yeah. Remember, this is a guy who went through this campaign simply whenever it was convenient for him, denying that he had ever said or done certain things, things that were documented in video and in writing in other ways. If this is the Donald Trump that we see as our incoming president, he doesn't seem to have any problem with it. I don't know at what point, though, his supporters begin to sort of get fed up with that. But this has been the modus operandi of this candidate through the entire process. How much of that he's inclined to continue, how much of that he can continue once he assumes the responsibility of the presidency, remains to be seen. But this is something that Trump has shown us he has no trouble doing, backing away, pretending that he hasn't said or done things in the past that he has.
Clearly, the GOP has already made overtures to embrace Donald Trump. It's a little bit sickening the way some of them are going to him now. Is really one-party rule what's coming, or do you think they're going to continue to be tensions between this unconventional president and mainstream Republicans?
In places where it matters, I think we are looking at a pretty unified Republican Party in the White House, in the House, and in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has already made it clear that job one is the elimination of Obamacare. The House of Representatives will be delighted with that, and there's no indication that that Trump will have any problem with that. So I think at least with some of the big issues coming down the pike, there will be that kind of unity. Of course, the Supreme Court is going to be there as well. I mean, these folks are going to have a nomination to put forward to a president of their own party. So at least initially, there's no reason, I think, for them not to take on the issues that, and there are some big ones there, take on the issues that they can all agree on. Whether it holds up as things go along remains to be seen, but I think that depends on what the impact of some of the early initiatives are.
Do you have any sense of how the Democrats are going to respond to this? Are they going to put up a fight, or how are they going to respond?
Well, I think they will try. I think strategically, if I were sitting down and talking with fellow Democrats about what happens next, I think there's a certain, maybe not long view, but medium view to this. And as I made reference to it a little before, it has to do with the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. I think that if there's a ray of light here, it's that when we get to 2018, which Democrats are already worried because the number of seats that Democrats have to defend in the Senate is vastly increased over what they had to defend this time, and the number that Republicans have to defend shrinks considerably. But Republicans in 2018 will now be defending the first 2 years of the Trump administration, and this could create a very different and much more pleasant atmosphere for Democrats to be going in than might have otherwise been the case.
Okay, back to the president-elect.
Yeah.
Greg, do you think he was expecting to win? Hoping yes, but did you get the feeling that it was a surprise to the Trump campaign as much as losing was to the Clinton campaign?
What I hear, and I don't know how much of it is true, but what I hear is that the Trump folks really did have some reason to be talking about this secret Trump vote, that some of their polling was showing that there were folks out there who were not necessarily, you know, the whole thing was, oh, people are lying to the pollsters. I don't think these people were even being polled or factored in. Again, you know, pollsters, you know, have a way of sort of figuring out, you know, who the likely voters are. And what we had were a bunch of people who would not show up as likely voters. But what I'm hearing is that the Trump campaign did somehow, it picked up some indication that there were at least some of these. I don't think they expected things to go quite as convincingly as they did. And I don't know if the folks in the Clinton campaign missed it or saw it and let it go, didn't think it was viable, but that's what I'm hearing.
Greg, I know it's maybe too early to even ask this question, but did this campaign have enough influence that it's going to impact the way we do politics in the years ahead?
Oh, I don't think it's too early at all. I think the answer to that is an emphatic yes. This guy broke every rule from start to finish, right through the general election, and it will change the way potential candidates look at their possible candidacies. It will change the way political professionals approach this. It will change the way the media covers elections. Yes, absolutely, it will change the way we go forward, and I think by and large not in healthy ways.
We've got a lot of talking to do in the weeks ahead, Greg.
Oh, yeah.
As always, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's good to talk to you.
As much of the religious right clearly came together to elect Donald Trump as president, many observers don't expect him to be particularly involved in their issues. VP-elect Mike Pence is another story indeed. His theocratic, anti-gay, anti-woman political career is something we urgently need to take a closer look at. And joining me now is People for the American Way senior fellow Ari Rabin Hoft. And so, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
What do those of us concerned about our constitutional system of government need to worry about regarding Mike Pence?
Look, I think Mike Pence, as governor of Indiana, has taken some very aggressive positions that call into question some really fundamental constitutional protections, including freedom of the press and the rights of the LGBT community, in terms of, first off, trying to pass this so-called religious freedom statute that was anything but. It was a freedom to discriminate law, and doing things like trying in Indiana and getting pushback to set up his own government-sponsored media that would short-circuit the press in his state.
Hmm. Let's remind folks in a little more detail about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that he was promoting as governor, and help our listeners understand what was at stake there.
What was at stake was essentially a right to discriminate, right?
Right.
And it's this weird principle. Religious freedom laws first were pushed by actually progressives way back 20 years ago on the idea that we need to have a constitutional protection for people to practice their religion. I think broadly, I think that's something most Americans agree with. The problem is the protection of your religion has always stopped where it extends into practices that discriminate against other people. So, for example, when civil rights legislation was being passed in the 50s, 60s, and when the Supreme Court started stepping in, there were some people who wanted to continue discriminating against African Americans who decided they would try and use the church and religious freedom to do that. It was used in an attempt to avoid desegregating public schools. There's a famous case involving a restaurant called Piggy Park Enterprises, where basically the restaurant didn't want to serve African Americans in the same way they served white people, and actually was distributing pro-slavery material. And the Supreme Court ruled that they were not permitted to discriminate against their customers in that way, and saying that it was their religion was not an excuse. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the 1980s Bob Jones University, the U.S. case, where the Supreme Court very clearly ruled that your religion does not allow you the right to discriminate against groups. Mm-hmm. And these freedom of religion laws are basically a repudiation of that notion.
Ari, what about his time in the legislature? What do we need to remember about those years?
There's a lot to remember about those years. I mean, this is a guy who led Congress's efforts to defund Planned Parenthood, which, by the way, interestingly enough, completely separates him from Donald Trump, who Donald Trump, if you'll recall, during the primaries, said he was steadfastly opposed to abortion, but also said that he understood the important work that Planned Parenthood does outside of abortion, which is far greater acknowledgement than any, and far be it for me to praise Donald Trump, but this is something that Donald Trump and Mike Pence separate on, is things like that, where Mike Pence in 2011 tried to defund Planned Parenthood. Mike Pence also, frankly, made it a goal of his to privatize and cut Social Security. He was one of the leaders of that in the House of Representatives. My other favorite or least favorite moment for Mike Pence was his floor speech slobbering all over Rush Limbaugh that he decided to give. That he went down to the floor when he had a sick, I think it was child at home, and he said this, but it was so important he had to be there to praise Rush Limbaugh that day, even though he was dealing with a sick kid.
Hmm. All right, you've worked closely with some of the leading figures in progressive politics. May I ask you how the conversations have gone among these folks since Election Day? Were they as unprepared for this outcome as many of us were?
Yeah, I think there is an honest sense of shock. I mean, look, the fact is, even you hear from the Trump people, they didn't think they were going to win that day. Mm-hmm. Everything we know about polling and modeling, and by the way, here's the thing that people should know. Tens of millions of dollars was spent at all levels, House, Senate, presidential level, doing models on voters, scientifically looking at data, figuring out what was going to happen, who was going to vote, and everybody's models failed, including the Trump campaign. They actually thought they lost. So everyone was kind of unprepared for this moment. I mean, I was at the Javits Center on Tuesday night, and prior to 9 o'clock that evening, there was a sense of elation and jubilation in the room. At about 9:30, you just felt the oxygen start getting sucked out of the room, and by 11, you knew it was over.
Mm-hmm. How do the people that you know, do they understand who the vice president-elect is and know the dangers that he poses for progressive politics and certainly progressive religion?
No, I don't think many people know who Mike Pence is at all. You know, it was such an interesting race. I don't think Mike Pence has any sort of name recognition or ID or knowledge about who he is. So if I were thinking about a figure who's kind of stealth, it's Mike Pence. And I think it's exceedingly important for progressives and all Americans to have a better understanding of who our leaders are. And right now, with Donald Trump, he's kind of an enigma on policy. And with Mike Pence, it's kind of everyone's brushed it aside during this campaign.
How optimistic about how the president-elect and the vice president-elect are going to get along?
I actually think he's going to rely pretty heavily on Mike Pence. I think he knows that he's weak when it comes to the areas of governance, and Mike Pence is well-connected and very centered in D.C. conservative circles in a way that he isn't, and I think he's going to lean heavily on Pence. Also, we know Trump doesn't care about policy or isn't into policy, and Mike Pence actually is, and that's a dangerous part.
Mm. Well, all right. Tell us what your briefing would be for people who are going to be dealing with Pence and what they need to know about him in doing that.
I mean, what people need to know is Mike Pence is a movement conservative all around. Mike Pence was a guy who probably, if he didn't run into a harsh wall as governor of Indiana, would have set himself up to run for president. Mike Pence is a guy who has been on the far right of every economic and social issue for 20 years. Mike Pence started his career as a conservative talk radio host. So Mike Pence is a dangerous and compelling figure in the Trump administration, and the amount of influence he will have is an exceedingly scary thing.
Ari, I appreciate you being on State of Belief. I have to say, the briefing was important, and I hope that everybody feels exactly like I do at this point. You're a smart person, and what you've said is scary, and we better heed what you said.
Well, I think people should.
Well, man, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. You're always welcome here.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's great to talk to you.
Well, before the voting started in this year's election, it was already very clear to us that the divisiveness and distrust that the campaign both fed on and then in turn amplified would need to be addressed in the election's aftermath. And so, we were planning to present a series of conversations around the themes of healing and reconciliation. The contentiousness of this week has been even worse than we'd feared. And so the urgency of addressing the wounds our democracy is displaying is only escalated. This is just the first in that series of conversations. Across the years, I've been grateful to be able to call on Rabbi Brad Hirschfield for wisdom and insights at different significant moments. And so I am really happy to have him join with us today. Brad, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me, Welton.
Were you shocked to see people marching in the streets of New York and other cities this week chanting, "Not my president"?
You know, Welton, I want to be clear. I was both shocked and even a little dismayed, and yet not shocked at all and totally understanding of it. So let me explain. In the sense that people are really concerned, based on at least pieces of Donald Trump's record, certainly in word and sometimes in deed, about what it means for him to be the president, I share some of those feelings. I have to be really honest. Mm-hmm. This is not the person whose candidacy I supported, and it was about more than simply policy for me. Mm-hmm. So the fact that people are saying, how can I identify with him as, quote, my president, I do have some understanding of that and appreciation of it. That said, I find it ironic since, like many people, I was one of the ones who was worrying about if he lost, were his supporters going to go into the streets and challenge the legitimacy of President Hillary Clinton?
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of him winning, we got just the opposite, where people who supported Hillary for president have now themselves taken to the street and are using the very same language of he is not my president.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the real issue is here, we have a body politic which is not really divided by ideology, but questions the fundamental legitimacy and authenticity of those they oppose. And that is a very serious threat to all of us, whatever policies or positions we take.
Mm-hmm. Brett, are we pressing too hard for reconciliation too soon?
Well, I think it's such a good question. I don't know that it's ever too soon to at least open the door to mm-hmm. reconciliation,
mm-hmm.
in theory.
Yeah.
In practice, though, timing is everything, but even more importantly, Will, I think the path to reconciliation doesn't actually come by inviting something from others.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from turning inward and asking of something from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that each of us is going to have to ask ourselves, as painfully complicated as this may be, what is it our side did to get us into this mess? I think it's going to be really important for us to ask, what is it that has allowed each side to have such contempt for about half of the American population? In effect, what I'm suggesting, if we were using the Jewish tradition, is that the path to repair and restoration comes through first practicing penance and return to our own best values. That the challenges we face, if we're on the losing side, and I count myself among that losing side in this election, is not simply that we fail to market our ideas as effectively as possible. It does have to do, and it's hard for me to say this, with having completely misapprehended the felt needs of half of our fellow citizens, and at worst, actually having contempt for them. And then I would invite those on the right to ask, what does it mean that they were only able to coalesce in victory around a message that was so deeply angry? And what does it mean to build support off of that kind of rage?
Well, let's talk for a second, because that's a very strategic and profound way of approaching this. But let's stay for just a second on the side of people who are feeling hopeless, feeling betrayed, feeling more fear. What counsel do you have for them or for us?
So I would say let's try not to lump, they're all important, the three emotions you just talked about, which was hopelessness, fear, and betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they can feel betrayed unless we actually do what Mr. Trump was suggesting, and frankly I deplored before the election, suggesting that it was rigged.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that we've been betrayed. Because just losing doesn't mean you've been betrayed. It means you lost. And that's true in life in general. If every time something bad happens to us, it becomes not just that we lost out, but that we've been betrayed, that is a recipe for the kind of rage which most of us who oppose Donald Trump found so deplorable about him, frankly.
Yeah.
So I don't want to become like the one I oppose just because now it's viscerally satisfying to me. So I think we do have to put aside, frankly, and that takes discipline, this sense of being betrayed. Sense of being hopeless? I don't know. It seems to me that at its best, hope has been one of the terms nurtured by the more progressive elements of our political culture. And now we're going to have to practice what we have preached for so long to others. How do we not lose hope? And if we can't do that, then it turns out that what we've been preaching really wasn't so good to preach because we can't practice it ourselves. So again, we have to turn inward and ask, in what can we still take hope at this moment? In terms of fear, look, I don't want to be naive.
there are some things here which maybe are worth fearing, except typically we don't make our best decisions in fear alone. So I would say take stock of what there is to be afraid of, address it by first taking stock of ourselves, and then reaching out to others and seeing where we go from here. But on neither side can this be a debate about how to better market our own thinking. It has to become, where is it we are missing the felt needs of our fellow American brothers and sisters who may not share our political views?
Brad, there's been evidence that anti-Semitism, as well as other kinds of hate and bias, are on the rise and have seen elevation during this campaign. What should each of us be doing right now to push back against hate that may have been liberated by recent events?
Every time anyone is animated to build a sense of self based on the danger posed by others or the hatred we feel of them, take a breath and ask instead, even if you believe what you believe is true, I think it's patently false, whether it's hatred of Jews, Muslims, it's false. But let's assume it is. I'm not going to convince someone otherwise. Building a sense of self based on hatred of others will never bring you any joy. So at those moments, what I would say, forget it is what you hate about them, whoever your them is. What is it you love about being you? What is it how your best sense of being who you are as a Christian, as a Muslim, as a Jew, as an American, as a Democrat, as a Republican, as a progressive, as a conservative, how does that best understanding of who you want to be help you to accomplish what you want to accomplish, not how to oppose someone who isn't already like you?
Where in the history of your faith tradition do you look for the wisdom that we need right now?
Well, I guess there are a couple things. First of all, I look at the creation story and the rabbinic imagination, which has angels challenging God. Why would you create these people? They're going to mess things up like you wouldn't believe. And God casts that truth to the ground and raises up the deeper truth of love and says, because I love them and I want them to be. I understand all the good arguments for freaking out at this moment. But how are we going to allow our love of our fellow human beings and fellow Americans to, forgive the expression, trump the truth of our analysis about those with whom we disagree?
Would you talk for just a moment about why it is so important that we try to get over our angriness and the silos to which we take it and not be permanently alienated from people with whom we are convinced that we don't share anything in common?
At the very least, in the most pragmatic sense, I would invite people to ask if that was ever the ground from which they made the decisions about which they are most proud in their lives. I am willing to be open to the value of being more closed and more alienated, but someone will first have to show me where that is ever the path to the best possible decisions we make. There is a legitimate reason to be afraid sometimes in life, and biologically, the instinct toward fear is what keeps us from putting our hand into bushes and getting bitten by snakes. So I get that fear is a part of an appropriate human response to tense moments. But when fear is the guiding, animating emotion, it never leads us to the best decisions. And so our own self-interest demands that we figure out how to transcend some of these boundaries and ask questions of ourselves than we do of others. Not for them, and not for even America, though I believe that is the case, but for ourselves and our own happiness and our own personal futures.
Is it fair, Brad, to look at the recent events we've experienced, historic as they may be, and try to put them into a broader historical context, or is that a cop-out?
I think if it brings people a certain clarity and ability to move forward, it's worth it. If people feel like that's kind of nitpicking and not paying enough respect to the emotion of the moment, I wouldn't push anyone to do it. I think there is a time and place for that. Here I'd be very pragmatic. If it helps as a resource toward reorganizing our ability for self-critique and building bridges with others, then history is a useful tool. If it feels like a distraction that diminishes the emotion or the power of this moment, don't worry about it. We can do that another day.
How optimistic are you about the nation's ability to come together eventually in the weeks and months ahead?
As a person of faith, Welton, I feel called upon to be optimistic. I think that's what it means to be a person of faith, whatever your faith or tradition, is to fundamentally believe that the world as it is not the world as it will be, and that people have the ability to transform it. So in that regard, I'm always optimistic and would always challenge anyone who calls themselves a religious person or a spiritual person who's not optimistic, at least more often than not, but we all have moments where we're depressed, including me, to really check in with their faith. It should make you optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
That's from my heart. My head has a lot of questions. I don't know how many of us are really willing to take the personal risks on either side and feel the vulnerabilities of reaching out to people, not simply who we think are wrong, but really, I think, we're demonstrably wrong, and really take the risks to go through something together. I hope that we are. My faith demands that I feel that we are. My head says that every day is an opportunity to push myself and anyone I talk to in that direction. If I had to hold up a scorecard, I don't know. I know it's better than 50%. It's certainly not a sure thing. But since I guess I think that's probably the scorecard on most of life, I can live with it.
Well, Brad, listening to you, you always bring great insights. Thank you so much for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure, brother. If I do that, it's because you ask the wise questions that push us all in the right direction. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. We'd love to have your voice involved. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.